soldiers. Morse code, war cobras. Ooh, watch for the venom in the stash. Snakes hide, but what if you can't cut the grass? Cause it looks like a stack of money, and you sold your soul, and you think everything is so funny. Hold, call please, collect line, click, switch over, redirect, mass transit. They trying to charge you $250 for a token, plus 75 cents, $325 if you open. I'm still hopping the train with no ID. Talk about it's them against us. Go ahead, swipe me. Yeah, I ain't buying a Metro card, it's Petro Guard. I'm trying to beat like Lumia in the yard. Got everything on lock, like hair follicles in my scalp. While they calling me Ralph, I crammed them to the moon without honey. This is how it go, everybody hop along, silly bunny rabbits. Tricks is for kids, blacks get the biz. Get clapped in their chest, and he was only a kid. There's too many names for me to yell, but right now I think Rakim, but I really think Rommel, or Rob Marley, or anything you say. It's Bob Marley, he'll kill you if you can motivate the race to permeate love, and permeate love. They want you to radiate and evacuate slugs. No dubs, there's no justice, just us. So when you see me, brother, don't beef. Link up, lock arms, do what's important. Keep your money in your own pocket. Don't give nobody no more, stop it. No more Jordans if you gotta rock them, steal them, or cop it for low, extra half in cash. Then go to the pad and do the math. Peace!
Oh! Rod Stars, John Mega, C-Ray's Walls, you tuned in to Rebel Diaz Radio. Let's go.
Don't be scared.
Our special guest this evening is Dr. Rebecca Mercury.
And yeah, that would be okay, though. Who did that? That's GG. Hey, I like that one for us.
She's also a digital forensic investigator, typically working for criminal defense on a wide variety of cases, including hacking, murder, and financial fraud. Hey, Rebecca, how are you?
Thanks very much for having me on this evening, and good to be here.
Rebecca, yes. this is Jared King, and the last time you and I talked on the air, I think it was during the election of Abraham Lincoln. I'm not positive about that.
Maybe Alexander Hamilton.
But when Hank
more,
and I...
More popular politician.
And my question is, malware to get into millions of cameras and doorbells and thermostats and whatnot, how easy would it be for them to use that same technique to foul up our election?
Did people do anything about it? And the same is true about the voting machines. I mean, I've been testifying about voting machines since the late 1980s, and at that time, only a handful of people, I mean, we're talking like a dozen people, were really concerned about this and were saying how dangerous these things were. It's gone back and forth. You know, after the Bush versus Gore election, a whole bunch of vendors said, well, we can solve all this hanging chad by going to electronic voting machines. And then more and more computer scientists, not a lot at first, but more and more computer scientists joined me and some others who are prominently saying that this is wrong. There's no paper trail. There's no way to audit the election. And so basically it sort of got wound back. And now, right now in the country, I understand the statistics are it's about 40% are voting electronically. About 60% are voting on paper, but even the paper ballots are being scanned electronically. So the problem you have is that with anything that's done by the computer, there is the possibility of malware or...
On Friday, November 18th, join the BAI family for the Commons Brooklyn First Annual Karaoke Night. Sing your heart out for WBAI, a night of songs from the 60s. Sing the Beatles, the Stones, the Crystals, the Ronettes, the Shirelles, the Supremes, and many more. Come sing, have fun at the First Annual Commons Brooklyn Karaoke Night while you support WBAI. That's Friday, November 18th at 7 p.m. at the Commons Cafe, 388 Atlantic Avenue between Hoyt and Bond Streets in the Borough Hill section of Brooklyn.
Santa Claus is coming. do down. Take it, gentlemen.
Hi, I'm David Kenny, inviting you to join me for the annual Everything Old is New Again holiday concert to benefit WBAI. It's Sunday, December 4th at 12:30 p.m. at the Metropolitan Room. Again, that's Sunday, December 4th at 12:30 p.m. at the Metropolitan Room for the Everything Old is New Again holiday concert to benefit WBAI. For more information, visit givetowbai.org.
He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good, so be good, for goodness sake.
Hello. This is Mike Pinder, co-founder of the Moody Blues. You're listening to WBAI, New York.
This is Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, encouraging you to register today for State of the Black World Conference 4, scheduled for November 16th through the 20th in Newark, New Jersey, hosted by Mayor Roz J. Baraka. One of the great national, international gatherings of black people in the 21st century, organized around the theme, It's Nation Time Again, Racial Healing and Collaboration for Black Empowerment with Danny Glover, Susan Taylor, Dr. George Frazier, Dr. Julianne Malvo, Dr. Mark Lamont, Hill, Jaziri X, Nataki Cambone, and leaders of the Movement for Black Lives, the Global Reparations Movement, and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. That's State of the Black World Conference 4, November 16th through the 20th in Newark, New Jersey. For further information and to register today, visit the website ibw21.org. That's ibw21.org or call 888-774-2921.
The WBAI Community Advisory Board is holding open meetings for all to attend on the first and third Sundays at the atrium at 60 Wall Street in New York. So, what's the cab? Well, we advise management on programming and we volunteer and help out at the station. So please come, bring all your questions and your opinions. And again, that's on the first and third Sundays of the month at the atrium at 60 Wall Street, New York.
New York, New York.
And this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Stay tuned in just a very short moment. We will begin Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. Hello, Paulette.
Hello, Catherine.
Hello, Matt.
Hi, how are you?
All that time to get the music up, and then the VLC player went amok. So we're starting over with the music. So we are very happy to be here live with you today. So Paulette, maybe give a little preview of what is coming up.
Well, given the the charged moments we are living in, full of anxiety and wonder at what the future will bring, I conducted an interview earlier on today with a political analyst by the name of David Swanson, who, amongst other things, is author of several books. Most people know him for his book called War is a Lie. And he was also a Nobel Prize nominee for the years 2015 and 2016. Mm-hmm. And so we have what I hope will be an interesting discussion on the Trump phenomenon and the implications of what we found out about Hillary and the role of bankers in war, mm-hmm. and what all of this may bode for foreign policy and the way other governments receive us in the future.
And following that, we're going to have a bit of a discussion about how we are taking this in personally, and we'll be inviting you to join us with your phone calls. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back. And this is Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight.
My the Indians, who welcome the pilgrims, and to the buffaloes, who once ruled the plain. Like the vultures circling beneath the dark clouds, looking for the rain. Looking for the rain. Just like the cities that stagger on the coastline, and a nation that just can't stand much more. Like the forest buried beneath the highway, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance to grow. And now it's winter. Winter in America. Yes, and all of the hillers have been killed. Sent away. The people know it's winter. Winter in America. And ain't nobody fighting, 'cause nobody knows what to say. Save your soul, Lord knows, from winter in America. The Constitution, a noble piece of paper, with free society, the struggle but they died in vain. And now democracy is ragtime on the corner, hoping for some rain. They look like either hoping for some rain. And I see the robins perched in barren treetops. They're watching last-ditch races marching across the floor. But just like the peace signs that vanished in our dreams, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance to grow. And now it's winter. It's winter in America. And all of the hillers have been killed or betrayed. Yeah, but the people know it's winter. It's winter in America. And ain't nobody fighting, 'cause nobody knows what to say. Save your soul from winter in America.
Today is Wednesday, November 9th, 2016, the day after Donald Trump was declared president-elect as the next president of the United States of America, Republican defeating Hillary Rodham Clinton. And we are here this evening to discuss some of the implications of this phenomenon And we are pleased to have with us Mr. David Swanson, who is an author, activist, journalist, and radio host. He is director of worldbeyondwar.org and campaign coordinator for rootsaction.org. Swanson's books include War is a Lie, published in 2010, When the World Outlawed War, published in 2011, and The Military-Industrial Complex at 50, published in 2012. He is the host of Talk Nation Radio, and he also works on the Communications Committee of Veterans for Peace, of which he is an associate non-veteran member. And Swanson is also Secretary of Peace in the Green Shadow Cabinet. Welcome, Mr. Swanson.
Good to be here. Thanks.
I guess many people are in sort of shock or perhaps a sense of numbness over the results overnight of the win of Donald Trump over Hillary Rodham Clinton. Just to cover this, what do you think just happened?
Well, I've been despairing the horrendous state of the U.S. government for years now. You know, this didn't start for me this morning. And I think it's something you survive. It's something you learn to live with and you learn to resist and to work to change and to work to transform. But the United States last week was a militarily mad nation, devastating the climate and the other natural environment of the planet, and in pushing war and weaponry on the globe in a disastrous manner, and today it still is, and it would have been whichever was elected, and we were guaranteed in this election to elect someone even worse than our current president. We were guaranteed to elect, you know, a disastrous individual to the White House. But you know, if it's any consolation to people, elections are not what matter. They are not what changed the world. They are, we have not voted serious social progress into being ever. It's a small component of the work of nonviolent activism building momentum for change, and that goes on, and it goes on much better starting today with the election obsession behind us. And if it's any consolation, you know, Donald Trump got fewer votes than McCain or Romney got. Of course, Hillary Clinton also got fewer votes than McCain or Romney got. Most people stayed home. Nobody liked these people. And the Democratic Party had a winning candidate in Bernie Sanders and cheated him out of a possible nomination. So, you know, all the stuff that everybody tells each other about the demographic shift and young people being smarter and so forth is all true. You just can't put your hopes in a broken electoral system with an unpopular candidate. And yes, we elected a racist, sexist buffoon, but, you know, working people, lower-income white voters in places like Pennsylvania voted for Barack Obama, and now they voted for Donald Trump. So there's more than just racism here. You know, that's one ugly part of it, but that's not the whole story.
What is part of the rest of the story?
Well, resentment of a corrupt establishment that's been impoverishing people and the earth, as well as devastating nations abroad for years now. I mean, if that were not the case, you wouldn't have the existence of these, you know, burners for Trump groups, these people who were for both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, which makes absolutely no sense apart from corporate trade and possibly certain aspects of militarism. Makes no sense at all. They're exact opposites on every important policy, but they were both seen as somehow newcomers against the system, as Barack Obama was seen, perhaps somewhat unfairly, as an outsider against the system, although he was a senator for years. You know, this is what people wanted. They wanted opposition to a completely corrupt establishment, and when Donald Trump put out advertisements to that effect and everybody just screamed anti-Semitism, it was a little bit of a cop-out. Maybe it was anti-Semitic, but it was absolutely correct in its critique of the establishment. The response ought to have been, yes, that's correct, but Donald Trump will not fix any of those problems. That ought to have been the serious response, rather than that's anti-Semitic, or he's an agent of Vladimir Putin, or any of this sort of nonsense that just made the Democrats look stupid and dishonest, rather than serious and caring.
One thing that struck me in the lead up to these elections was the WikiLeaks release of the emails from Hillary Rodham Clinton when she was Secretary of State, and as well as some of the materials that came out where she released the transcripts of her speeches that she had hidden up to now, speeches before bankers and representatives of financial institutions where they discuss financing of war. And I wanted to ask your opinion on some of the findings from those speeches and really discuss what the roles of these financial institutions are in the perpetuation of war.
Yeah, it is remarkable that, the demand for the videos or transcripts of these meetings with Goldman Sachs bankers that Hillary Clinton was paid so handsomely for actually made news. But then when we actually got some of the transcripts, it was just a yawn from the corporate media. There was no desire to look at what was there, although what was there was actually quite interesting. It was, a different face of Hillary Clinton. Who knows if there even is an authentic one. This was her Democratic pitch to a bunch of Republican bankers' face, but it was also her, whispering behind the scenes, in a not for public manner with banker friends and corporate allies. And here she is talking primarily about where to wage wars and what wars to wage and how to dominate the globe for a bunch of bankers, which is not how the U.S. democratic system is usually depicted to the public. And she's blurting out things like that her no-fly zone on Syria would be a mass murderous act, far worse than Libya, would require, as she says, killing lots of Syrians, and she actually condemns people who are out there glibly talking about such a thing, whereas she was at the time and is today the leading person out there glibly talking about such a thing, which is why there's a huge chunk of the world out there outside the United States in that other 96% of humanity that does see the U.S. as having elected the racist, sexist buffoon over the candidate of the Enlightenment. But there's another huge chunk that sees us as just having held off World War III because Hillary was intent on bombing Syria and said Barack Obama was wrong not to bomb the hell out of Syria 3 years ago. And even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington is saying this would have guaranteed a war with Russia. I mean, this is why Russians are celebrating, because we don't know what Trump will bring, but at least this is not the president of shipping weapons into Ukraine and trying to start up World War III. This is, we've elected a guy who actually blurted out the obvious common sense that NATO has outlasted its purpose, although he immediately backtracked under the slightest pressure on that, rather than Hillary Clinton, who told Goldman Sachs that she was proud of having told the Japanese the United States had a right to the entire Pacific and had discovered Japan and had purchased Hawaii, and, that whole ocean was ours. This is not how she talks in public. This is how she talks to bankers, and that ought to have been news.
And in terms of the actual influence and enduring influence of these bankers and financial institutions, what role do they play in shaping the militaristic landscape on a global level?
Well, we also know from leaked emails in recent weeks that it was top Wall Street bankers who picked the nominees for Barack Obama's cabinet, or most of them. We know that both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have lined up the same crowd of corporate lobbyists allied with Wall Street interests to shape their cabinets. With someone like Donald Trump, with his limited literacy and limited intellectual ability and attention span, this may matter even more. Who ends up being the voices around him, the other powers in the room. And these are shaped routinely in both the Democratic and the Republican parties by Wall Street interests, by military interests, by the overlapping cartel of these powers that control our financial systems, our information systems, and our major industry as weapons dealer to the world. And you know, the corruption was rather unique in Hillary Clinton's case with the Clinton Foundation, but it's normal now. And you know, the big appeal from Donald Trump early on was his pretense that he was outside the broken system, that he wouldn't have to take any bribes because he could fund his own campaign. And then he backtracked on that and started taking all the legal bribes that are part of the U.S. political system. You know, again, there's something he's acknowledged, that the system is broken. Will we be able to push him in the direction of fixing it? That remains to be seen.
And just taking it a bit further with some of what came out in those emails, we know that she admitted that certain governments in the Middle East were directly involved in the funding of these militaristic groups there, ISIS, ISIL, and that a lot of the work was done through a sort of pay-for-play arrangement with the Clinton Foundation. Given what she's just revealed, how does that bode, for instance, for a Trump win? What do you think will come of such funding, or how will a Trump administration play into or have a role in continuing that funding? What is your view on that?
Yeah, we know from those emails that Hillary Clinton knew that Saudi Arabia and Qatar were funding ISIS and supplying ISIS. We also know that she knew that the United States was supplying so-called moderate fighters who were actually aligned with al-Qaeda and the so-called extremist fighters. We know that Saudi Arabia and a half dozen other nations in that region put millions of dollars into the Clinton Foundation, at least $10 million from Saudi Arabia, and then, you know, another $900,000 from Boeing, and she made it her mission, as we're told, to get those airplanes sold to Saudi Arabia that are now blowing up men, women, and children in Yemen. I mean, this was a unique sort of form of corruption, and we don't know exactly what corrupting influences there will be on Donald Trump, but we know he's surrounding himself with hyper-militarized advisors, and we know that even as he said that NATO may be obsolete and that this new Cold War with Russia is a bad idea and so forth, he's also said, I want an even bigger, even more expensive military. I want to bomb the hell out of them. I want to start killing their families, as if that weren't U.S. policy for the past couple centuries. And so it remains to be seen what sort of movement arises. You know, will there be a moment now, like in 2002, 2003, when everybody who identifies as a Democrat joins the peace movement for a while here? Will we have a bigger peace movement even than we had in 2003, 2004? And will that have any influence? Will it be a movement built across the political spectrum and able to operate strategically and courageously to have any influence on this Congress and this president? It remains to be seen. We don't know. No reporter in the whole, you know, almost 2 years of this campaign asked either candidate what they wanted to spend on the military, even though it's over half of federal discretionary spending. So we don't know in detail. You know, the one thing we know about Syria and that crisis is that Russia, for years, has been open to a nonviolent settlement that would even have included Bashar al-Assad stepping down, which is the big goal of the U.S. government. And we know that Donald Trump is willing to talk with Russia. You know, that is potentially an encouraging change, a positive change. You know, we may have just held off World War III by electing a racist, sexist buffoon, and we have every good Democrat, you know, running around denouncing any non-hostile action toward Russia. It's a very, very strange situation to be in.
And I just wanted to go back to something you mentioned. You mentioned Donald Trump's advisors. Who are they?
Oh, I had a list in front of me earlier this morning, but they are, you know, the sort of most encouraging is Michael Flynn, I believe his name is, who, you know, left the Obama administration and began denouncing, you know, the drone wars as counterproductive. And yet he's quite a militarist and allied with neocon right-wing militarist schemers like Michael Ledeen and others. And they're going to be in a room here with, you know, just a catalog of, you know, the most right-wing extremist former Congress members and senators, from Newt Gingrich to Jeff Sessions and on and on, shaping the Trump policy. And it's going to be very interesting for Democrats to, you know, large D Democrats to suddenly discover that, you know, as some of us have known and has been available public knowledge for 5 years now, the president, the current president, goes through a list of men, women, and children on Tuesdays and picks whom to have murdered with missiles from drones. Is the new president going to do that? And is that going to be a problem now? And are we going to be able to build a bigger movement to resist it? You know, it is having a half dozen wars going at the same time around the world without congressional authorization or any fig leaf of legality. Is that going to be a problem now, and are we going to be able to resist it because it has this different face on it? And I certainly hope so. I would like for us to do so in a principled, policy-based manner, but if we can do so in a, you know, as a matter of partisanship, so be it. Anything we can do to end these wars is what I'm looking for. And Trump is both horrible and potentially good news in that regard.
And as you talk about financing of wars and ending of wars, what effects do you think that, in case that the wars are actually intensified, what further effects do you think they will have on domestic policy when it comes to social services, when it comes to issues such as the health care, I would say, pilot program that Obama implemented, as well as the funding for other social safety nets?
Well, you know, it's not just the wars, but the routine base military spending that is at least 10 times the price of any wars, and it is, you know, higher in the Obama administration than any previous administration, and peaked around 2011 and has gone down very little since then, and is roughly $1 trillion a year, roughly the amount of the rest of the globe, allies and others combined, is absolutely out of control. And the U.S. public has no idea what that level is, but is in favor of reducing it. And in fact, the U.S. public, in a poll commissioned by the Koch Institute, of all people, says that the wars of the past 15 years have made us less safe and should be ended, and we should have fewer of them, not more of them. But that same U.S. public buys into the fears of who are our greatest dangers, starting with ISIS and Russia and Iran on down, and you get down to 4% of our country says climate change is the biggest concern. I'm in that little 4%. Donald Trump is likely to exploit those fears, likely to heighten the paranoia about these foreign dangers, and to increase those dangers through the counterproductive measure of escalating these wars. And those dollars are drained out of the U.S. economy. Despite all the military jobs we see, it's a mirage. You get fewer jobs and worse paying jobs with military spending than even with tax cuts for working people, much less investment in infrastructure and human needs and education. And so things are going to be cut. And a separate part of Donald Trump's agenda, of course, is to cut useful spending, to slash it left and right. Will he, as a businessman, audit the Pentagon for the first time in history and find out what it's spending money on? Not without massive pressure to compel him to do so. But he will cut other services. You know, healthcare is something that he wants to cut as a matter of principle. But Obamacare was something that was going to keep seeing the prices go up regardless. It was going to destroy itself. Now it's going to be destroyed more swiftly. But healthcare is not actually where we need more money. We just need to cut out the waste, cut out the insurance companies and create single payer, which again we now know Hillary Clinton secretly recognizes is the only solution, but wouldn't publicly even pretend to stand for. But these are the trade-offs now, and these are the trade-offs when Trump is president. More wars means less for anything else, and it means increasing the weaponization and the militarization of local police, and it means saturating our culture with more racism and hatred and violence, which works its way from the wars to the domestic scene and the other way around.
And given all of the frighteningly negative aspects of all of this, what indeed are the prospects for peace? What are some of the solutions?
Well, I think coming around to recognize that backing off from a new Cold War with Russia or with China could be a good thing, and you know that to be a good liberal or leftist does not mean denouncing all friendly, cooperative, law-abiding gestures toward Russia. That would be a huge step, and this campaign has been a, you know, has been a disastrous move in a dangerous direction in that regard. You know, if NATO can be backed off of Russia, you know, and if putting this ugly, racist, sexist, bigoted face on the United States helps the rest of the world back away from support for U.S. wars, so much the better. You know, those dozens of nations around the globe that have big U.S. military and NATO military bases in them, if they can understand that those represent their subservience to the odious Donald Trump, you know, so much the better. Close them. Shut them down. You know, bring those troops home. They're doing nothing but damage abroad. Shut down that expense, you know, and make peace with the world. We're not going to see an internationalist here. We're not going to see you know, voluntary signing on to treaties and the rule of law. But we may see pressure from the rest of the globe. The International Criminal Court is suggesting it may prosecute crimes in Afghanistan. It may indict a non-African for once. We may see the rest of the world begin to stand up. Germany is voting tomorrow in the Bundestag on whether to continue engaging in U.S. wars, and it's a very different vote from what it would have been last week. You know, so there may be progress, and we may need to work globally as a community to see it happen.
So in other words, the world could benefit in a way through these sort of unintended consequences.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't have picked Donald Trump. I wouldn't have picked Hillary Clinton. Both are disasters. But if there's any silver lining in Donald Trump, it's that we won't see the world delude itself as it did during 8 years of Obama's war making that he was some sort of messenger of peace and justice. On the contrary, the world is primed and ready to recognize that here we have a dangerous individual, but someone who might not exactly have the Hillary Clinton agenda of humanitarian war after so-called humanitarian war. So there are openings, there are possibilities, but we have to make very clear and bring our pressure to Washington, D.C. to say that we have had enough of the wars. Those little, you know, bits of campaign where Donald Trump blurted out the truth that overthrowing governments is disastrous, that NATO is obsolete and so forth, we need to play up those and demand follow through on those rather than on banning Muslims, building walls, and killing families.
Well, on that note, David Swanson, I'd like to thank you very much for being with us tonight on Part of Mine Earth at Midnight. And please let our listeners know how they can follow your work.
Well, my website is davidswanson.org, and an organization I direct that I'd love for you to go and sign our statement of peace that's been signed in over 130 countries is World Beyond War at worldbeyondwar.org.
Okay. Well, thank you for the interview.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
President Kill is Dead. So what was that piece of music, Paulette?
It was by the group XTC, and I think it was produced in the 1980s.
Yeah, and it's an album called Oranges and Lemons. And before that, we played Gil Scott-Heron. And what was that?
Winter in America.
Winter in America. So this segment is produced, of course, by Paulette Spencer for our program here, Heart of Mine, Earth at Midnight. That was a fabulous interview with David Swanson. I thought it was very poignant and very clear, a bit humorous. I loved his take on things. That was a great interview. Thank you for bringing that for the show. Matt, what do you think?
Well, I'm very anxious to get to his website, davidswanson.org, mm-hmm. and World Without War. It sounds very interesting to look at. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing is that strikes me about Donald Trump and all these people in Washington, they are in upper income brackets, but particularly Donald Trump, he was born into that wealth. So all his life, he never knew any lower socioeconomic paradigm. And someone like that tends to be insensitive to most of us folks in a lower socioeconomic paradigm. So you wonder what he's thinking and what these other people are thinking in Washington.
Well, they're not thinking about the lower socioeconomic group, that's for sure. I found this whole, it was a wonderful interview. I really enjoyed it, Paulette. And this whole election campaign has been a very trying thing. I'm just grateful it's over. You know, I'm very, very grateful it's over because it was so consuming with toxic negative energy and thought and, you know, pulling people into that level of hatred and fear. I thought that was very, a horrible place for us to be going as a society. But I have to say I wasn't surprised that Trump won. I think a lot of people were a little bit overconfident with the Hillary Clinton potential for her winning. But I didn't have an investment either way. I didn't like either candidate. But I wasn't surprised. And this is primarily because of the sort of the energetic pull of the campaign. That it, if you look at the law of attraction, the energy put out is the energy that you get. And most of the people who were voting, not most, a selection of the people who were voting based on fear. Well, I'm really afraid of that guy, so I'm going to vote for her. I'm really terrified of her, so I'm going to vote for that guy. And so I believe that fear became the dominant energetic force of the election. And in that case, it sort of attracted the person who was really putting that fear-based thinking out. And so from an energetic perspective, if people were looking for even, you know, someone like Bernie Sanders, or people were supporting Clinton out of love and respect and expectation of positive energy, then she would have had a better chance because energetically people were attracting that as opposed to moving through fear and repelling. So I wasn't particularly surprised that Trump won. I'm not particularly fearful about his what his presidency might be, because I was actually more fearful of Clinton. I was one of those people who thought that she was particularly politically dangerous in terms of the international scene. I think that Trump may very well bring more violence and negativity domestically. But it's generally the international war that gets us to the point of losing the planet, you know, and having real problems with survival of the civilization. But it'll be interesting to see. And I agree with what your guest, David Swanson, said. I think maybe people of sound mind are going to have to come together to build a real strategy at this point. So, for instance, I think maybe there needs to be a massive convergence at Standing Rock. You know, we're sitting around watching these indigenous water protectors be abused, you know, attacked by dogs, water cannons. And this is what we went through in the civil rights movement. How are we standing by and allowing these indigenous people, not that it's just the indigenous people, but it's really the coming together of the indigenous that have made this challenge. And there needs to be thousands of people there, maybe millions of people there. So we have to build a different strategy, and I'm hoping we'll be motivated to do that with this Trump presidency instead of another, you know, pull the wool over our eyes presidency.
I mean, when I think of it in the terms of all of these sort of dynamics that have sort of come into play against each other, including these revelations through these WikiLeaks documents, I thought to myself, wow, you know, I don't know what Julian Assange had in his mind in releasing this, but if I could think of a third party sort of coming to the fore, mm-hmm. this would be the opportunity for it, where you're sort of seeing all of the dirty laundry, as it were, in the two leading parties, and it could give sort of a window of hope for a viable third party mm-hmm. In the future. I mean, you may have sort of a germ of it now, you know, with Jill Stein, mm-hmm. but it would be wonderful if over the next few years something like what she represents could grow.
Yeah, and I guess Bernie Sanders was making that effort to create a grassroots movement as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is what's going to be required. I don't think that the status quo and the stakeholders in Congress, in the presidency, in the corporate world are going to change.
Well, like Jill Stein was saying on her interview just last week, she was saying, well, we should prepare. Whatever happens, we should prepare for the next 4 years so that, you know, these candidates have a chance. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a strategy along those lines. Absolutely.
Exactly, so that the corporate powers can't so easily shut down. I mean, that's the one thing that's good about these revelations, as you said. It takes away any illusion or delusion about what's really going on. And so one could easily begin to recognize that whatever this country is, a democracy isn't one of them. So if you're out there and you'd like to join us, if you have a thought or a comment, we have a few moments to receive your phone calls, 347-335-0818, 347-335-0818. If you want to join us with your comment, now would be the time to make that phone call, and we'll add you into the mix. So let's hear a little bit more music. Janice Ian, Black and White.
It's all gone. of his hatred and a dream gone up in flame. Coloring only at the fountains, congregations, soda shops.
Janis Ian, Black and White. Beautiful piece of music with a theme that is both thoughtful and relevant to our program today. We're going to be moving on to our next segment with Matt reading, catching us up on Ishmael. If you would like to respond to what you've heard so far, now would be the time to do it. 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. And as I don't see a call coming through at this time, let's go to Ishmael. So, Matt, catch us up on what this is all about.
So, this is basically the book it deals with a young man who answers an ad requesting a student with a sincere desire to change the human race. And answering this ad, the teacher who placed the ad turns out to be a gorilla. And they establish this sort of telepathic dialogue between them. And they deal with issues of how civilization, how things came to be this way. And we are up to now chapter 6, division 1, where Ishmael, who is the gorilla, asks his student, "And how are you feeling today?" Ishmael asked. Palms sweating, heart going pitter-pat. I gazed at him thoughtfully through the glass that separated us. This wrinkle-eyed playfulness was something new, and I wasn't sure I liked it. I was tempted to remind him that he was a gorilla, for God's sake, but I held it in and muttered, "Relatively calm so far." "Good. Like the second murderer, you are the one whom the vile blows and buffets of the world have no incensed that you are reckless what you do to spite the world." "Absolutely." "Then let's begin. We confront a wall at the boundary of thought and your culture. Yesterday, I called it a monument, but I suppose there's nothing to prevent a wall from being a monument as well. In any case, this wall is an axiom stating that certain knowledge about how people should live is unobtainable. I reject this axiom and climb over the wall. We don't need prophets to tell us how to live. we can find out for ourselves by consulting what's actually there. There was nothing to say to that, so I just shrugged. You're skeptical, of course. According to the takers, all sorts of useful information can be found in the universe, but none of it pertains to how people should live. By the way, we're dealing with two groups of people, the takers and the leavers. The takers are the agriculturalists. They came later. And the leavers, well, just what was there. You know, you ate, you picked it off a vine, or you found it. So, according to the takers, all sorts of useful information can be found in the universe, but none of it pertains to how people should live. By studying the universe, you've learned how to fly, split atoms, send messages to the stars at the speed of light, and so on. But there's no way of studying the universe to acquire the most basic and needful knowledge of all the knowledge of how you ought to live. That's right. A century ago would be aeronauts of the world were in exactly the same condition with regard to learning how to fly. Do you see why? No, I don't see what aeronauts have to do with it. It was far from certain that the knowledge there would be aeronauts were looking for existed at all. Some said it wasn't out there to be found, as there was no point in looking for it. Do you see the similarity now? Yes, I suppose. There's more to the similarity than that, however. At that point in time, there wasn't a single piece of knowledge about flying that could be considered certain. Everyone had his own theory. One would say the only way to achieve flight is to imitate the bird. You've got to have a pair of flapping wings. Another would say, one pair isn't enough. You've got to have two. And another would say, nonsense. Paper airplanes fly without flapping wings. You need a pair of rigid wings and a power plant to push you through the air, and so on. They could argue their pet notions to their heart's content, because there wasn't a single thing that was certain. All they could do was proceed by trial and error. Uh-huh. What would have enabled them to proceed in a more efficient way? Well, as you say, obviously some knowledge. But what knowledge in particular? Lord, they needed to know how to produce lift. They needed to know that air flowing over an airfoil. What is it you're trying to describe? I'm trying to describe what happens when air flows over an airfoil. You mean what always happens when air flows over an airfoil? That's right. What's that called? A statement that describes what always happens when certain conditions are met. A law. Of course. The early aeronauts had to proceed by trial and error because they didn't know the laws of aerodynamics. Didn't even know there are laws. Okay. I see what you're getting at now. The people of your culture are in the same condition when it comes to learning how they might live. They have to proceed by trial and error because they don't know the relevant laws and don't even know that there are laws. And I agree with them, I said. You're certain that no laws can be discovered concerning how people ought to live. That's right. Obviously, there are made-up laws, like the laws against drug abuse, but these can be changed by a vote. You can't change the laws of aerodynamics by a vote, and there are no laws like that about how people should live. I understand. That's what Mother Culture teaches. And in this case, you agree with her. That's fine. But at last, you have a clear understanding of what I'm attempting here to show you. A law that will agree is not subject to change by any vote. Okay, my mind is open. But I can't imagine any way in the world you're going to accomplish that. What's the law of gravity? Ishmael asked, once again startling me with an apparent change of subject. The law of gravity? Well, the law of gravity is every particle in the universe is attracted to every other particle, and this attraction varies with the distance between them. And the expression of the law was read where? What do you mean? It was derived by looking at what? Well, at matter, I suppose. The behavior of matter. It wasn't derived by a close study of the habits of bees? No. If you want to understand the habits of bees, you study bees. You don't study mountain building. That's right. And if you had the strange notion that there might be a set of laws about how to live, where would you look for it? I don't know. Would you look into the heavens? No. Would you delve into the realm of subatomic particles? No. Would you study the properties of wood? No. Take a wild guess. Anthropology? Anthropology is a field of study like physics. Did Newton discover the law of gravity by reading a book on physics? Is that where the law was written? No. Where was it written? In matter, in the universe of matter. So again, if there was a law pertaining to life, where will we find it written? I suppose in human behavior. I have amazing news for you. Man is not alone on this planet. He is part of a community upon which he depends absolutely. Have you ever had any suspicions to that effect? It was the first time I'd seen him raise a single eyebrow. You don't have to be sarcastic, I told him. What's the name of the community of which man is only one member? The community of life. Bravo! Does it seem at all plausible to you that the law we're looking for could be written in this community? I don't know. What does Mother Culture say? I closed my eyes and listened for a while. Mother Culture says that if there was such a law, it wouldn't apply to us. Why not? Because we're so far above all the rest of that community. I see. And can you think of any other laws from which you are exempt because you're human? What do you mean? I mean that cows and cockroaches are subject to the law of gravity. Are you exempt? No. Are you exempt from the laws of aerodynamics? No. Genetics? No. Thermodynamics? No. Can you think of any laws at all from which humans are exempt? Not offhand. Let me know if you do. That will be real news. Okay. But meanwhile, if there does happen to be a law that governs behavior in the community of life in general, humans would be exempt from it. Well, that's what Mother Culture says. And what do you say? I don't know. I don't see how a law for turtles and butterflies could be of much relevance to us. I assume the turtles and butterflies follow the law you're talking about. That's right, they do. As to relevance, the laws of aerodynamics weren't always relevant to you, were they? No. When did they become relevant? Well, when we wanted to fly. When you want to fly, the laws governing flight might become relevant. Yes, that's right. And when you're on the brink of extinction and want to live for a while longer, the laws governing life might conceivably become relevant. Yes, I suppose they might. Subsection 3 of Chapter 6. What's the effect of the law of gravity? What's gravity good for? I'd say that gravity is what organizes things on the macroscopic level. It's what keeps things together. The solar system, the galaxy, the universe. Ishmael nodded. And the law we're looking for is the law that keeps the living community together. It organizes things on the biological level, just the way the law of gravity organizes things on the macroscopic level. Okay. I guess Ishmael could sense I had something else in my mind because he awaited me to go on. It's hard to believe our own biologists aren't aware of this law. Lines of amused astonishment crinkled the blue-gray skin of his face. Do you imagine that Mother Culture doesn't talk to your biologists? No. Then what does she tell them? If there was such a law, it doesn't apply to us. Of course, but that doesn't really answer your question. Your biologists would certainly not be astounded to hear that behavior in the natural community follows certain patterns. You have to remember that when Newton articulated the law of gravity, no one was astounded. It's not a superhuman achievement to notice that unsupported objects fall toward the center of the earth. Everyone past the age of 2 knows that. Newton's achievement was not in discovering the phenomenon of gravity. It was in formulating the phenomenon as a law. Yes, I see what you mean. In the same way, nothing you discover here about life in the community of life is going to astound anyone, certainly not naturalists or biologists or animal behaviorists. My achievement, if I succeed, will simply be in formulating it as a law. Okay, got it. Subsection 4. Would you say that the law of gravity is about flight? I thought about that for a while and said, it isn't about flight, but it's certainly relevant to flight in as much as it applies to aircraft in the same way it applies to rocks, and makes no distinction between aircraft and rocks. Yes, that's well said. The law of civilization, it's not about civilization, but it applies to civilizations in the same way that it applies to flocks of birds and herds of deer. It makes no distinction between human civilizations and beehives. It applies to all species without distinction. This is one reason why the law has remained undiscovered in your culture. According to Taker mythology, man is by definition a biological exception. Out of all the millions of species, only one is an end product. The world wasn't made to produce frogs or katydids or sharks or grasshoppers. It was made to produce man. Man, therefore, stands alone, unique, and infinitely apart from all the rest. True. End of subsection 4.
Without you, the sweetest wine melts silently to water, and the moon shines lonely in the night. Try and see the me that needs to feel you with me now. Somehow, I don't know how I've known since birth. I'm without you, water. Please send a message to me. Let me know you're on your way. We'll set our spirits free. Happen to collide.
Listening to On Earth by Rita Selby from the CD On Earth, and you can find out more of her work at RitaSelby.com. So Matt, that was a lovely reading. What do you get from that piece? What do we derive from that? I really like that reckoning of coming to a realization that maybe the problem is man feeling that they're better than everyone else or every other species and every other law, and don't have to follow any of those laws.
Well, this is evident in the way we're destroying the planet.
Yeah.
And we go on and go on. How we got away with it for this long. I mean, it's okay to pollute, to do fracking and destroy the earth,
yeah.
And push indigenous peoples off their lands because we want what they have. We want to exploit people. We want that cobalt for our cell phones. We want all, and we get away with it for this long. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, I think the planet is about ready to shake us off if we don't make a change, Paulette.
Yeah, I definitely think nature has its way in the end. And I think that nature is the great equalizer. And it's sort of a false notion that we control it. It actually controls us.
Indeed. Well, ultimately, you're right. It will. It most definitely will. And I think, though, that we have still an opportunity to redeem ourselves as a planetary race. If we can begin to see ourselves as a planetary race and realize how interdependent our lives are with the planet.
Well, you know, not only the planet, but the universe.
Certainly.
We are not alone. There's life on other planets. People don't like to think so.
But to me, it seems very obvious. And it's true, when you think in terms of the planetary and globally and as far as the universe, certainly every planet affects the Earth. We certainly wouldn't do very well without the sun. So I think if we can begin to expand our ability to regard each other as of the same family, you know, like the indigenous people, all our relations. You know, you might not want to be alone in the jungle with a tiger, but the tiger has a right to be there, and it's not upon us to destroy every other species for our own convenience. So we are close to being out of time, so we're going to leave a little space for Jim Freund to come in and do his program. Thank you very much, Paulette, for your program, your interview. I thought that was fabulous.
Thank you.
And Matt Mazza, thank you so much for your reading.
My pleasure.
And I want to thank all of you for joining us this morning and wish you a lovely, lovely remainder of the day. Hopefully you'll get some rest at some point, but maybe you're a night owl and you're just up with us at this time. You've been listening to Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. I'm Catherine Davis with
Paulette Spencer
and
Matt Mazza.
We invite you to return and join us again next Wednesday into Thursday morning for Earth at Midnight. Heart of Mind.
A long time has passed since I've seen your face, and the words that I stood for you've gently replaced. Deep in your arms, warmed by your smile, I feel your heartbeat, it's whispering. Dry your eyes, give yourself to me. Sometimes it can't be what you want or what you think you need. Let it all go and go with the flow. You can find peace of mind breathing. Melts silently to water, and the moon
never shines lonely in the night. Try and see the me that needs to feel you with me now. Somehow, I don't know how I've known since birth. I'm without you, honor. Please send a message to me. Let me know you're on your way. We'll set our spirits free. Without you on earth, and without you by my side, singing till you hear me till we happen to collide.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, well, feels like we're living in an alternate universe, doesn't it? Stay tuned. And good morning. So, this will be a bit of a free-form program. I do have agendas to meet. Originally, I thought I was going to read something either really political or really apocalyptic, and I was looking. The only thing that I could find that really seemed to match the mood of the day for me was a great, great short story by Cyril M. Kornbluth, from 1951, entitled The Marching Morons, which is largely about a real estate swindler who is able to con a great many people who are very sheep-like in a far distant future. And the adventures that he has, unfortunately, I figure that the story would take about an hour to read, and there are other things to do this morning. And if you can hear me, you know, as I breathe, I go, you hear there's a little phlegm there, and I'm just not ready to do a live, not recorded, 1 hour long reading. But doing so, you know, how do I maintain some kind of relevance? I feel that there must be some relevance this morning, because when I woke up with what was by now yesterday morning, I had, for the very first time in decades, the feeling that I used to have as a child. I'm born in 1953. So I am born in the era of the Cold War, with all the saber rattling, or should I say missile rattling, that was going on. When I'm 10 years old, I'm living through the Cuban Missile Crisis and stuff like that. And we did drill tests going to the shelters in school. And every day at 12 noon, there were, all through New York City, where I was in Queens at the time, air raid sirens, every single day at 12 noon. And it was, you know, it did not do anything to soothe people at all. I don't remember exactly what year they stopped doing the air raid sirens, but it was, enough into my youth, so that I would wake up every single morning, I mean every single morning, and have a deep-rooted fear of a mushroom-shaped cloud. And I'm hardly alone. I think anybody near my age experienced that, and probably of other ages, and probably in other parts of New York and the country and the world. I was talking with a gentleman who hails from Egypt, who drove me over here this morning. I took a car service because I really didn't feel like doing the bus today. And he grew up also with constant fear of war and that kind of thing. Well, I had that this morning. I really did. I was like paralyzed for maybe 90 minutes or so. And then later on, I took a nap, and it's just been whatever. The word that I have been using, and I think that, you know, is shell-shocked, but that's not quite it, because shell-shocked, you know, is an early word for PTSD. It's a phrase that will probably change as time goes on. But it is, nevertheless, indicative of the kind of total, near-paralyzing fear that one can feel, and it is back. So, therefore, in a way, the program will have a certain amount of business as usual. But in another way, it's also, well, this talk, this rap, this discussion about the state of the earth, the state of this country. I mean, I really feel like we stepped into an alternate universe. I'm reading a wonderful book right now by, you see, I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, James Gleick. If it were German, it would be Gleick. But then, you know, there was my good friend John Gleidman, who's married to Margot Adler, and he was IE, and he would himself point out that technically speaking, his name would have been pronounced in many places Gleidman. So it's either James Gleick or Gleick. I think it's probably Gleick. But anyway, he has a new book about time travel. I'm about two-thirds of the way through it, and it is an utter joy. It's the man knows his sources. He has cited, you know, starts out with H.G. Wells, but this doesn't stop him from mentioning, in fact, C.M. Cornbluth and Ursula K. Le Guin and a lot of Heinlein, because By His Bootstraps is an absolute classic story of its type, to, for God's sakes, David Gerrold. And each chapter is about a different aspect of time. And a lot of that includes, of course, alternate universes and the philosophies behind them. Now, this is not a book about science fiction. This is a book about time. And a lot of it over the, you know, traveling forward, traveling back, and, of course, alternate universes. Is it, and causality and effect. The philosophy that if somebody in the 17th century wrote down a note of music and somebody in the 21st century plays that music on, say, a trumpet, and the air vibrates at a particular frequency in reaction to that trumpet, which was the cause? Was it what was written 200-something years ago? Was it the trumpet player? Now, remember, we're not discussing hard science or reality here. We're discussing philosophy, okay? And it's a wonderful book. What can I say? But I feel like this is a universe in which the impossible, the unthinkable has occurred. And it also strikes me that we're living in the same kind of a world that my parents must have known. My father from Nuremberg, my mother living mostly in Prague but born in Frankfurt, both Holocaust survivors. My brother and I born here in the U.S. by design. They were among the very, very few allowed into the U.S. for particular reasons. And to them,